Barney Hill, even that was never mentioned in a book, had a sperm sample taken from him when he was on the examining table in the UFO. So we knew about this, that there was that reproductive interest. That what happened, it was in 1983, as I was investigating this Indianapolis case, a woman I called Kathy Davis, it turned out that she began speaking very emotionally about the fact that she had had a pregnancy, which was very unusual that she had gotten pregnant. She had not been sexually active hardly at all, and that the pregnancy disappeared, and that those two events were connected, the getting pregnant and having the pregnancy disappear, were connected with certain memories she had of a UFO aspect of some kind of incident. But she also had this extremely vivid memory, or a dream, she wasn't sure, of being shown at some later point a small child. And the small child, she was told, was hers, and that it was not fully human. It was a mix of herself and the aliens. And, of course, all of this sounded outrageous, and yet all along I had been getting reports from people suggesting that ova and sperm samples were being routinely taken.
Well, now, do you think that, did she have some missing time where she had...
Oh, yes.
...actually gave the birth to the baby, or was the baby taken out of the womb?
The baby was removed at some point, probably in the third trimester. The third month of the first trimester. And she had no bleeding and no sense of a miscarriage, but she knew in the morning that she was no longer pregnant, and found out, in fact, she was no longer pregnant. And I began to find...
Well, do you think it's some kind of Hitler complex for a super race, or do you think they just can't reproduce?
Well, again, we don't know. The fact that this is going on, that they're doing this, seems to me beyond doubt at this point, but as to what the motives are and what their problems are, we can only speculate.
But have you got any idea what happens to the babies? Do they stay with the spaceships?
Yes, exactly. They stay with the craft. We also have a lot of reason to believe that many of these, let's say, genetically engineered mixes are not working out. In other words, there are serious problems with
why do you base that? That's an interesting statement. Why do you say that?
Well, people have been shown infants that seem to be, the phrase, babies that don't thrive. In other words, they seem to be filled with lassitude, quiet, they don't look healthy, they don't seem to move much. Sometimes people have been shown babies that are quite deformed, as if certain aspects of their bodies have not developed normally. And it would seem that whatever this program is, that it's not some kind of absolutely efficient...
Even though this race of extraterrestrials probably is far advanced of us...
Yeah.
They've got the problem that it just doesn't...
Doesn't take every time.
Uh-huh, you're right. It's in other words, that's a pretty scary thought there. What happens to these children? I wonder.
Yeah, and also exactly. And also, numerous people have described being in a craft and taken into a room and showed, and they were shown things that looked like tanks, incubating tanks in which developing fetuses were floating. And
maybe it's just as simple as they should allow them to stay in their human host till full term. I wonder why they don't.
Well, the interesting thing is that the UFO occupants seem to feel that there's something magical about human touch and about the maternal instinct. And if you look at it this way, if you can imagine that, and this is pure speculation, that the alien race, whatever they are, have not had to reproduce in the normal way for centuries or whatever, and that all their offspring are produced in vitro, In other words, they're all test tube babies mm-hmm. or whatnot. If that's the case, then the maternal instinct might have atrophied and
disappeared from
the sexual instinct, and therefore, because we have such really powerful maternal and paternal feelings for our children, and of course we have such strong sexual instincts for one another, that maybe these are qualities which they want to reintroduce in their particular evolutionary position, wherever they are. I mean, this is speculation, but something like that may be very possible.
You know, you're following that line of speculation along, then this race could be very old chronologically.
Well, certainly their technology is incredibly advanced over ours.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, we...
I was thinking more of the inhabitants themselves. What are the little grays, or are there different types of people?
Well, the gray figures are, you know, I've always said they're... About 85% of the reports are of the gray figures. And even when we get reports, as in the Travis Walton case, of very human-looking figures who seem quite, you know, well-constructed and handsome and so forth, they're actually right there with grays cooperating, doing the same thing together.
Yeah. I've had Travis on two or three times over the years.
Wonderful guy.
Uh-huh.
Well, you see, in terms of evil, I mean, one has to assume the possibility that the ultimate goal here is it's not going to be a happy outcome for human beings. I mean, that is certainly a very logical reading of the data as we have it. You see, we're not getting right now any sense that they are deliberately hurting people. In other words, if they take a child out of the bed and at night, and the child is extremely frightened and put on a table and examined and poked and prodded and so forth, they do something to reassure the child that they won't be hurt and they'll be taken back and so forth, and the child is tucked back in bed. And incidentally, I should point out that sometimes the child is put back wearing somebody else's pajamas.
Really? Now, I hadn't heard that before, bud.
Well, I've got many cases where a person is abducted at night, we'll say, and obviously they're then stripped inside the ship for the examination and these procedures. And if there are a number of people in the ship, sometimes that they get one another's clothes on by mistake.
So in other words, these people may be advanced, but they still are capable of bungling.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. People, I mean, there are many, many, many bungles. People are put back in the wrong beds, in the wrong rooms in the houses, or even sometimes in the wrong house. They're put, the car is put down, and one case, after a car had been taken, lifted up, it was put down in the middle of a field with some trees around, and there was no way for the car to get out of the field. They had to cut down a couple of trees, which was made the point.
Now, these bunkers would have problems with that one.
Yeah, oh, but they all come up with something. See, if you're a true believer, as the bunkers are, you'll find a reason. You'll say, or maybe it was never put down there that way, and people just lied, you know, or something. They'll come up with something, because they have to defend their ideology, and they will do anything. Some of them, at least.
They're talking about the debunkers.
The debunkers, yes.
To make sure their theory works.
Yeah, that this is not accepted. Of course, what we're asking, I was incidentally. Gave a lecture once in Westchester County, and I was contacted by a man who said he was from the Westchester Skeptical Society, and he invited me to come and debate with him. And I said, I don't do debates. I said, I don't go and debate. I said, we've been having nothing but debates over all these years, and it hasn't gotten us anywhere. But I said, I'll tell you what I will do. I said, if you have a psychiatrist who is a skeptic or whatever in your group, and he's interested in actually investigating a case with me from whatever premise he wants to operate from, I said, let him get in touch with me, and we'll look into it together. I said, let's do a joint investigation. Let's not do sitting trying to, you know, make debaters' points against one another.
It's just your skeptical society.
And they never replied to me.
Yeah, they were skeptical.
they didn't want to do an investigation. They
sure, I understand what you're saying.
They want to sit there and tell you all the points why this can't be. This can't be because you can't get here from there, wherever there is, and you can't travel in space, and aliens wouldn't look like this, and et cetera, et cetera. They have a list of things. And in other words, they're arguing from the point of view of theory, and they're trying to make their theories refute our data.
Has anything downright comical ever come up?
Well,
the reason I ask that is, you know, you're talking about the pajamas being on the wrong
side. Well, we have one there that was a woman, actually she was just listening here this past weekend, and she lived in Ohio at the time, and she had bought a new nightgown she was very proud of, a Victoria's Secret nightgown, and she went to bed, and she woke up in the morning knowing that something had happened. She had dim memories, you know, the typical kind of fragment of memories. And she realized she was wearing some big, bulky, green man's T-shirt.
I'd like to see the man.
Which made out the man was wearing when he walked out.
Who said that this research business is all dull?
Well, but funny things do happen sometimes.
I was living in Baltimore at the time, and I was visiting my girlfriend. I was driving home from Frederick on Route 40. I saw lights starting to follow my car. They came down out of the sky. It was very late at night. It then flew off, and it scared me very badly, of course. And the next thing I knew is my car was ripped off, literally ripped off the side of the road, the highway. And I thought I was going to crash. The next thing I remember is I must have hit my head or blacked out or something, because I remember sort of staggering out of the car, climbing, sort of staggering around to the right side of the car. I was off the highway at this point. And there was a bright light in front of me. And I looked to the right, and there were five little guys. I was led into a saucer, for lack of a better word, and I was led into a room, and some sort of an operation was performed on me. I thought that I was somehow a little bit different, maybe a little unusual, maybe singled out because, for example, I was in very good health, I was a professional athlete. In retrospect, I don't think any of those things were the reason. I think my feeling is that it was very random, that I was in the wrong place.
That was one of Bud Hopkins' investigations and one of his witnesses. Larry Dickin came across another one of Bud Hopkins' witnesses. And I think you'll find this part of the show very interesting. Listen carefully.
My guest, his name is Robert Croyland Stitt, and Gary, just call him Robert or Roy.
Okay.
Bob.
Can I call you Bob?
Yes, Bob.
Okay, Bob. Okay.
And
or do you call him Robert, Larry? What do you call him?
Bob.
Okay, we'll call him Bob.
And I tell you, it's quite an interesting story, because many, many years ago, in fact, in 1979, Bob's father had an experience in North Hudson Park here in New Jersey. Now, North Hudson Park is right next to the Hudson River, and it was the location of a very famous sighting that was Bud Hopkins' first reported UFO incident. That's what got Bud interested in UFOs and started him on his career as a UFO investigator. And this was the 1975 sighting in North Hudson Park that involved a UFO actually landing in the park. It was observed by a number of people, including a doorman at an apartment on the east side of the park, and also by a person driving in a car through the park, saw the UFO land, and little gray aliens got out, took some soil samples, got back in the craft, and took off. Now, Bud and I had a conversation last week, and I introduced Bud to Robert, and Bud and Robert have had an extensive conversation on this particular event, And it does involve missing time and an abduction, but this is not the same event as in 1975. It just happens to be in the same location. This occurred in 1979. And Bud informed me, and I was somewhat aware of this anyway, that North Hudson Park seems to attract UFOs for some reason. There have been a number of incidents reported in the park since 1975, and the last one I can remember was in the mid-1980s. There were a number of incidents reported there, and they probably still continue today. So, given that introductory information, Jerry, I'm going to turn you over to Robert, and he's going to tell you his story as related to him by his father, and you can take it from there.
Okay, Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jerry.
And I guess you and Larry have known each other for a while, and then all of a sudden he became aware of this only recently, huh?
Exactly.
So you don't necessarily run around telling people this story all the time.
No, not usually.
Why don't you let our listeners in on exactly, you start where you want and let's just go ahead and
Sure. Tell
us the story.
Well, it was 1979, and I was 13, going on 14. And my father was coming home from work, and he was driving on Boulevard East, which is right adjacent with the Hudson River. And he turned off into the park, which is North Hudson Park.
And how big of a park is this for our listeners? It's pretty extensive, isn't it?
It's a big park. It takes up, I think, around 5 blocks.
Okay.
It's a big park. And it's right across from the Hudson River, so it's the view of Manhattan. And a lot of large high-rises around it. And he was driving to the park, and he says his car stopped. And he saw this big bright light on top of his car. And then there was something in front of the car, like some kind of a ship. And all he really remembers was his radio went dead, and he kind of heard some strange things on the radio. Not sure what it was.
He never really told you what those strange things were. I mean,
he kind of said it was like a language he didn't understand, you know. Mm-hmm. And what all he really remembers is this ship in front of him, and the top of it opened, and he saw what you call now a grays, a little guy with the big eyes. And then it shut and basically took off, which he felt was like 10 minutes, if that. But he got home like 3 hours later, figuring it was just 10 minutes.
Yeah, that's pretty common in that. So he was gone for that long period of time, so obviously he was abducted.
Yeah, that's what we would think, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And now when he got home and told this story, of course we all thought he was crazy. You know, I was only 13, but my mother wasn't sure what was going on, you know. And he thought he was nuts, too. He didn't want the story to get out. He didn't want people to know about it, you know. That night, or the night after, he started having these dreams. Weird enough, it was about the Miss America, pageant, which was 1979. And he had these dreams, and he felt like it was real, like he was there. Now, he named the winner that year, which was Cheryl Pruitt, 1979, what state she was from, what she looked like, what color dress she was wearing, what song she sang. I mean, every detail possible. And
I wonder if you watched it on television.
Well, we did. We had friends over that night, and we were all watching it on television.
Mm-hmm.
And no one really took it seriously until she actually sang the song and wore the dress and came out and actually won that year. You know, he has no affiliation with the Miss America contest, you know.
That's pretty interesting, isn't it? I mean, do you guys feel, and did your father feel that he was transported down there, or does he have any theory?
I don't think he really discussed about a theory he had about it. You know, it was just basically.
Jerry, if I can interject here, it's not uncommon that abductees report that after their abductions, they seem to have heightened. Quote, psychic powers of various kinds, some of which is the ability to predict future events.
And of course, we theorized this before, Robert, that maybe they actually were into the future and back. That's some of the time travel theories involved in these things. I'm not sure that Larry or I buy into that, but it is common, isn't it, Larry?
Yes, it is.
So, So he was able to tell you anything about this Miss America pageant. You watched it on television. Everything he said was correct.
Everything. He said his dreams felt like he was actually there. You know, he even told us what he wore. You know, it was like it felt like he was actually there.
Boy,
he had everything on the money.
Boy, it would have been weird if they'd showed a shot of the audience, and there he was.
Yeah, it would have been a little startling. But, yeah, and I definitely feel it has something to do with the whole sighting, you know, whether it was an abduction or whatever you want to call it. But
How long was he missing?
Like I said, he was supposed to be home at a certain time and came home 3 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
But he felt it was 10 minutes. He had no idea what time it was when he got home.
So he was astounded when your mother said, well, where have you been?
Well, she was basically waiting up,
mm-hmm.
you know, worried where he was. And that's basically the situation when he walked in 3 hours late, and that was his story.
Now, when he had these dreams that were so realistic, you lived in the same household. I mean, did he make noises or anything about that?
While he was dreaming?
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't think so.
Okay,
I mean,
okay,
I was
curious.
In the room, but I don't think so. But basically, he just told the story, the dream he had when he woke up, you know. And that was it. He felt it was weird. He felt it was worth mentioning because it was different than any other dreams he had. It felt like he was actually there.
Did your father say during this time that when he was stopped there at the park? I guess it was no other traffic, just him with the spotlight and the UFO in front of him.
Yeah, he doesn't recall any other traffic.
And he does remember the little gray coming out. But to him, it seems like it just came out and went back in.
That's what it seems like, yeah. That's all he remembers was the top of the ship opening up and seeing the gray and then closing again.
Interesting, Larry.
Yes.
It's certainly interesting. I wonder, thinking about this, did your father remember more later on, or was this just basically all he said about it?
No, that was basically all he said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't really more than that.
So that's an interesting thing. And that's in Hudson Park?
In North Hudson Park.
And that's about, 150 miles from Atlantic City?
Yeah. Yeah, it's about
150
miles.
It's
right across the river from Manhattan.
Sure.
10 minutes out of Manhattan.
Sure, sure. So, I mean... the Miss America pageant. That's an interesting twist. I haven't heard that before. On
no.
Well, Larry Dickin, what do you think about it all?
Well, one other fact I'd like to throw in here real quick is the fact that, you know, when his father came home that night and told his wife and Robert about his experience, you know, he's saying, you know, I'm wondering if, you know, I'm the only person that saw this, or, you know, did anybody else see this? And, so the next day they checked the, newspapers, and specifically, paper that was published back then is called the Hudson County Dispatch, which is now a part of the Jersey Journal.
Mm-hmm.
And in the paper, there was an article that indeed reported this UFO incident, not particularly talking about him. This was another eyewitness observer, or perhaps several of them, in the area of the park did indeed see a UFO come down and land in the park. So that confirmed that the sighting, you know, was a real thing. Mm-hmm. Several people saw this craft. But he is the one that had the personal abduction experience.
Bob, has anything happened to you personally?
No, not to me personally.
Well, has Larry explained to you that some of these times these things run in the family?
Yeah, he has. I'm still waiting.
Well, it's interesting, and of course that fact about it being backed up would be a newspaper article, Larry, and then the Miss America angle. This is a unique story for sure, Bob. We appreciate it.
Yes, and Bud, as I said, is following up on this, and you know, if there's any way to get in touch, you know, with the actual eyewitness here and have him get together with Bud and do some regression therapy, it might prove some from meat to be some meat for a future book.
Yep. Okay.
So, you know, we'll be looking forward to hearing from Bud and what he has to say about this.
And, of course, Bud will be on this show again in August.
Right, August the 9th, he's scheduled to be on the show. Now, I think it'll probably be premature to ask him about this particular case at that point in time, but if something arises, then he'll certainly bring it up then.
Well, Robert?
Yes.
Thank you very much for being candid with us and telling us about that.
You're welcome.
And let us know. We want to be the first to know when you have your personal experience, if you ever do.
I sure will.
Okay.
It was a pleasure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Larry?
So Bud Hopkins will be missed. He passed away at 80 on Sunday afternoon. And much of his work still lives on thanks to his many books and many lectures and all of his research with the IntrudersFoundation.org. You might check that website out. Bud Hopkins will live on for some time thanks to his work and especially his books, The Intruders. It was a pioneer book on the abduction, and it actually got widespread distribution, including in many libraries all over the country, making all of a sudden the subject of ET abductions more valid for millions. Other books included The Brooklyn Bridge Incident and Missing Time. There were others as well, including an autobiography by Bud about himself and his art and his UFO research, his fascination with the UFO story. Bud Hopkins, we will miss you, but your work will live on. This has been a tribute to Bud Hopkins. I'm Jerry Pippin. Thanks for listening. Until next time, cheers.